It is just past 7:34 in the morning. The program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards Cheeker. Big news came out of the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday. And this committee, as distinct from the House Intelligence Committee, has been working in a fairly unified bipartisan fashion to do fact-finding on Russian influence operations before and after the 2016 election. In the course of doing that work, they commissioned two reports using data provided by internet platform companies, Google and its subsidiary, Facebook and its subsidiary, and so forth, trying to gauge the extent of those operations, the impact much harder to gauge. Among the big takeaways, looks like YouTube and Instagram, which is a subsidiary of Facebook, had much bigger impacts and were the target of much more resources than previously given credit for. Something that had already been discussed, definitely reaffirmed by the data that came out yesterday, there was heavy targeting of African Americans in these operations. Not necessarily to gin up support for Donald Trump, but certainly many, many messages that were clearly targeted at either spreading cynicism, encouraging people to not vote, or giving them bad information that would lead to them voting in a way that wouldn't get their vote counted. And the third takeaway is more about the relationship of tech companies in this country to government. The data that's in these reports shows that the initial testimony that was given to the public and given to the Congress about the extent of these operations was clearly misleading at its best. And also, the full amount of data that would be needed for an assessment of what was going on still has not been furnished. We're going to get into all of that with our next guest. April Glazer writes about tech for Slate. She is also one half of their tech podcast, If Then. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
So first of all, what were the big, like, eyebrows shooting up moments for you in the reports that got released yesterday?
Well, a lot of these reports kind of, or not a lot, but these reports kind of confirmed a lot of what we already knew, because stuff has been coming out since fall of last year. But what really stuck out for me was the role of YouTube, as well as the large increase in the use of Instagram after the 2016 election. So, like, you know, a lot of the narrative around Russian infiltration has been about how it was intended to sway the electorate to Trump. But clearly, you know, they were very, very active long after the election and wanted to keep, you know, their hands deeply involved in American political conversation.
Let's back up a sec. What are the two consulting companies that are writing these reports, what are they looking at? What is the raw data they have their hands on?
So they got data actually from tech companies. So they got data from Facebook, from Twitter, from Google, which owns YouTube. And remember, Facebook also owns Instagram. And the data that they got were posts and ads and social media activity from groups, or rather fake activist groups, that were being run by the Internet Research Agency, which is a kind of troll farm based in St. Petersburg that ran thousands and thousands of accounts in the United States, intended to kind of rile our political divides and also sway the election for Trump.
Okay. And how do they know for sure which accounts were being run by the Internet Research Agency?
Well, they've done research to link them, and you know, they have found, you know, something like 470 accounts on Facebook. They found numerous channels on YouTube, thousands and thousands of accounts on Twitter. And, you know, they're still finding them. This is not something that's over by any means. But they have found, you know, thousands of accounts that they've been able to link to the Internet Research Agency. Sometimes it's been obvious, like they used rubles in order to buy ads. But really what they're looking for is inauthentic activity, or activity that, you know, is coming out of St. Petersburg, but they're running an American Black Lives Matter account, for example.
Tell me about that account.
Oh, so there's many accounts. There's Blacktivist, there's Black Matters Us. You know, these were accounts that held events and protests and had hundreds of thousands of followers on Facebook and were sharing memes and kind of riling up their base, but were actually puppeted by Russian social media operatives. And, you know, one of these accounts that I looked into, Black Matters Us, you know, they had a Twitter presence, they had a Facebook presence, they had an Instagram presence, a Tumblr presence, a Google Plus presence. They had their own website where they were collecting donations via PayPal under under the guise that they were American Racial Justice Group, they even scraped events from actual black entrepreneurial groups, as well as like the MLK Day parade in Houston, and reposted those on their website and went through very, very great lengths to make it look like they were running an American, you know, racial justice nonprofit organization.
I'm guessing this was not for the sake of boosting the message of Black Lives Matter. Like, what can we divine about what the purpose was of building an audience around that message?
It was for the purpose of kind of angering Black people about the American government. So, you know, some of the stuff, for example, that was shared by Blacktivist, which is one of the large Facebook groups that also actually hosted events and protests that people went to or helped to support them. They posted a meme that says Black Panthers were dismantled by the U.S. government because they were black men and women standing up for justice and equality. And then there's a picture. It says, never forget that Black Panthers group formed to protect black people from the KKK and was dismantled by the U.S. government, but the KKK still exists. So, like, really trying to make African-American people in the United States angry and feel, you know, a sense of disempowerment or just straight up, you know, dissatisfaction with the U.S. government and how it's handled black justice movements.
Okay, but like, that's also basically true.
Sure, but when they are able to do this, then they are able to kind of foment anger that is, you know, perhaps justified because it's historically true, but it's coming from the desire to make sure that Americans continue to hate each other and divide on you know, issues of racial justice in the United States, which there's a long-standing, you know, divide here in the U.S. without any doubt, but it's something that they're trying to exploit in order to keep divisions ripe.
So that was kind of one prong of the analysis, was they're trying to stoke divisions without pressing any specific partisan agenda, just get everybody fighting with each other.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was specific election targeting, trying to harness the audience they generated around messages like this.
So
what,
like,
seemed like fairly transparent attempts to suppress votes of people who might be inclined to vote for Hillary.
So there were a lot of things that they were trying to do. I mean, they weren't just trying to get people angry. Like, once they had collected all of these people who were following them because of their memes and had like hundreds of thousands of followers, the account Blacktivist that shared the KKK meme that I had mentioned, they had a meme that went viral that of a woman holding a sign that says, "I'm not voting for Hillary, hashtag Hillary for prison 2016. So really trying to turn the African-American vote against Hillary Clinton, making sure that Bernie Sanders supporters just flat out won't vote. So there was a lot of voter suppression efforts and voter suppression efforts that were aimed specifically at black Americans. There's no question about that. And that really amped up right before Election Day in 2016. Another picture, a guy in front of a TV, a black man that says, "Everybody sucks, we're screwed 2016. So, like, a lot of kind of memes and pictures and social activities saying, like, hey, black people, why would we vote? Everything is awful. You have no power anyway.
Wow. Going to get into the top lines from some of the reports. This is cited in your article. One of the two reports released by Senate Intelligence, put together by an outfit called New Knowledge, reviewed a little over 1,100 YouTube videos purported to be produced by this Russian troll farm, the Internet Research Agency. 96% were either about police brutality or the Black Lives Matter movement. That's pretty intense targeting.
Yeah, they were very, very focused on this. And when I went back through, so in May of this year, Congress, the House Intelligence Committee, released a trove of over 3,000 ads that were purchased by the Internet Research Agency on Facebook and Instagram. And, you know, the extent of targeting that I saw that was deeply focused on people who are interested in African-American history, the civil rights movement, Malcolm X, HuffPost Black Voices. I mean, they were really targeting people specifically interested in kind of black culture and American black culture issues. You know, one, you know, the The other thing I will say is, let's move on. Sorry.
Okay. We're speaking to April Glazer. She writes about tech for Slate. She's one half of the If Then podcast, and we're discussing two reports released by the Senate Intelligence Committee, trying to get a handle on the scope of social media influence operations run by the so-called Russian troll farm, the Internet Research Agency, before and in the aftermath of the 2016 presidential election. Let's talk about the data that Senate Intelligence has not been able to get its hands on, because the report authors did draw some attention to this. What have the large tech companies been holding back?
Yeah, so for instance, Facebook has handed over a lot of the ads, but they didn't include the comments, for example, on the ads. So it's very difficult to know, like, were people convinced by this? You know, we could see that there were likes, we could see that there were shares, but we couldn't really read what type of conversation was being stoked by these ads. Likewise on YouTube.
Because a string of comments saying, y'all have your head up your asses, would be very different from a string of comments saying, like, right on, I'm not going to vote.
Possibly, yeah. I would show, first of all, it's all engagement on Facebook, so they would probably still show up in the same amount of feeds no matter what people said. But certainly it would be good to know what type of conversations these memes and these advertisements were spurring. I mean, were people really convinced by this? Were people, like, you know, seeing an ad saying Hillary Clinton is ill and we can't vote for somebody who's sick, and saying, oh, yeah, you know what? That's right. We can't vote for her. And it's hard to know if people were really convinced. Were people really dissuaded from voting because of the suppression efforts, for example?
Why would tech companies hold back that kind of information?
Probably because they're not looking for that type of analysis or for that type of criticism to be leveraged on them. I mean, this is something that we've known has been happening for, you know, 2 years now, since the 2016 election. And we have only learned that every time tech companies have disclosed something, they have not, they've underreported, or they haven't been completely, you know, forthright with the data or like the amount of people that were reached. You know, for example, we originally learned from Facebook that IRA trolls, Internet Research Agency trolls, reached 20 million users, right? But then they later said it was 126 million users. And then researchers said that with only 6 accounts, it looks like actually close to 340 million users were reached. And that's just 6 of the 470, you know. And so they just continuously underreport, and researchers are continuously getting more information and showing that these companies are not really revealing everything that went down, and are not telling us everything.
So I'm trying to understand why. I mean, it would seem like the internet platform companies have a stake in fixing this problem. Like, it's a reputational problem for them. It's becoming a prospective regulatory problem with them. What is the logic that leads them to not want to just come clean with the U.S. government, get out in front of it, say, we're working on fixing it and we'd welcome your help?
Well, they don't want to look like they were vehicles for what, you know, is one of the kind of largest voter manipulation efforts probably in world history. I mean, like, the thing is that, you know, their platforms were not misused in any way by Russian agents. They were used exactly how they were intended to. These are viral social media platforms that are made and designed for viral advertising. And the Russian groups were very, very good at it. I mean, I could start a Facebook group, you know, tomorrow about pro-guns, and I am not pro-gun at all. And if I'm good, I can get thousands of followers. And then, you know, is that inauthentic, right? I mean, there's no real rubric for dealing with this. And also, the whole point of these social media companies is that they scale rapidly, and anybody can make an account, you know, about anything, as long as you technically use your real name on Facebook. And so these groups actually operated exactly the way these companies intended them to. And so for them to come forward with how incredibly manipulative this activity was, or for them to be completely forthright with the scope of the activity, would kind of undermine their entire business model.
Well, I guess that naturally leads to the question that confronts Congress, and in particular the incoming Congress, which is, like, what can be done about it? First of all, what have tech companies done so far, and has it borne any fruit?
Yeah, I mean, so Twitter has gotten a lot better at cracking down on bot activity. I mean, for example, in the 20 debates before the 2016 election, I think it was the second debate, pro-Trump bots were tweeting seven times more than Hillary bots. I mean, there was just so much automated activity leading up to the 2016 election. It was really hard to tell what was real and what was not. And like it was just incredibly inundated. Twitter's gotten a lot better at that. They're actually like stopping automated accounts kind of before they start at this point. Facebook is reporting when they find inauthenticity a lot faster. So, you know, we've seen like 1 week turnarounds before the 2018 midterms. They created a war room, quote unquote, to find, you know, stuff once it starts to percolate and bubble up and is potentially problematic. But you know, what we're not seeing is Congress with you know, a sturdy bill on the shelf to pull down and rally support behind and say, hey, we actually are going to require these companies to report their efforts in making sure that foreign state actors are not trying to manipulate our elections and kind of undermine our electoral process, or we're not going to have transparency requirements, like, you know, right, or that would institute stuff like that.
I mean, I guess my question is, like, is the foreign state actor distinction even important? Wouldn't these things be exactly as concerning if it was Republican state parties in the Deep South using the exact same tactics to build up black audiences and then tell them, hey, vote the day after Election Day?
Yeah, and there are laws against, you know, voter suppression and things like that specifically. You know, this is not easy stuff to legislate around, and it's because these companies were specifically made so that, I said before, anybody can create a an account. And this is kind of this constant game of whack-a-mole that we're up against unless we really question the entire business model of social media platforms altogether. And that would require something like, you know, antitrust action to come in and say, hey, these companies are too powerful, they're too big, and we actually need to limit their power in some way by making them smaller so they can be more accountable to the platforms that they've created. I mean, right now there's an issue, and I think you're kind of getting at this, that these companies might actually be too big to regulate. Because anybody can do what Russia did. Russia did exactly what these companies have designed users to do. So you're absolutely right that this isn't an easy thing to legislate around. But it would be nice to see some congressional kind of agency here saying, hey, we want to make sure that there is reporting, there is transparency, there is, you know, checking on this, and they are like making a concerted effort and some sort of like statutory require or some sort of requirement ensuring that they're proving that they're looking for this. I mean, I'm just making something up here. I don't have a white paper on hand that would offer like a regulatory fix for this, but there's no doubt that these companies have not done everything they could. They have not even been forthright with the research in providing the kind of data that we need to find out exactly what happened. They've turned their head on numerous issues, not just when it comes to Russian interference, but hate speech and, you know, letting all alt-right groups that kind of lead to violence congregate on their platforms for years. You know, there's so many issues that we see, like targeted, like, you know, housing ads, that don't reach black people, right? Like all kinds of discriminatory issues that are perpetuated on these platforms that are not being handled well by the companies. So
I guess my question is, like, what would be the target for regulation if the government were to act? Like, what would you go after? Would it be the business model, the micro-targeting of ads? Would it be the ability to set up anonymous accounts? Would it be the overall data collection that allows for the micro-targeting?
Yeah, so the data collection is something that could certainly be regulated. And, you know, micro-targeting is only possible if they have a large amount of data. They know who you are and they know all of these really precise points about you. And so there's all kinds of, like, models for privacy regulation that would kind of limit the vast amount of information that's collected about us every time we surf the internet, whether it's, you know, data minimization type requirements that say, hey, we're not going to hold data on you for 15 years and know what you had for lunch, you know, 10 years ago. Like, that's not going to inform our ads today. And just like deleting stuff more regularly. There could also be limits on how ads are targeted to us. Like, you know, maybe we can't have ads targeted to us based on race and things like that. But that gets complicated. complicated because, you know, people advertise in magazines that are specifically geared towards interest groups. And so this stuff is really not easy to navigate around. But clearly the way it works now, where we're getting ads served to us based on very, very specific interest categories, has led to kind of perpetuation of stereotypes. It's led to the ability for advertisers to discriminate against job postings, like, for instance, against, you know, older people, housing discrimination, you know, all kinds of things that that are not technically, that wouldn't be allowed, say, offline. But because online there are not the same liability laws, we see this type of activity.
So let's talk about the liability laws for a second. Right now, all of these platform companies operate in a policy framework that was created in the very early days
Yes.
of the internet to try to encourage its growth and development, which basically gives them a get out of jail free card on libel that is not enjoyed by magazines or newspaper publishers or anybody else in the media business.
Yeah, you're talking about the Communications Decency Act that was from 1996, particularly Section 230 of that act. And that says that internet platforms are not liable for the activity that people do on them, which is basically allowed them to look the other way. Say, if somebody creates a racist Facebook group, you know, it's not their fault. Or if somebody coordinates violence on their platform, it's not their fault. Or if somebody, you know, insults someone, you know, they're not going to get any, there's no defamation thing that's going to come their way. And that was really, really important for the growth of these companies. It was really essential that they were protected from lawsuits, so they weren't getting sued left and right, in order for investors to feel confident throwing, you know, tens of hundreds of millions of dollars for these companies to grow. You know, if they thought they were going to get sued left and right, then they wouldn't have gotten that investment and they wouldn't have grown so rapidly. But it's also allowed them to look the other way as abuses has really run rampant on their platforms and really not pay attention to the fact that, for example, you know, thousands of accounts are being created by Kremlin-linked operatives that are attempting to sway the election, or that, you know, people like Alex Jones have been using YouTube for years to stoke hatred and lead to, you know, real-world violence. You know, we see this over and over and over again, and a lot of this has to do with the fact that they're just not liable for what happens on their platform.
But what would a different liability framework look like? I mean, like, if the comparison is a newspaper, mm-hmm. right? The New York Times is liable for every letter to the editor that it puts in print because it's published it, even
Yes.
though someone else wrote it. If you extended that kind of liability to every user-generated post on Facebook or Twitter, it's hard to imagine Facebook or Twitter continuing to exist.
Yeah, no, and I don't think that eliminating the Communications Decency Act is the answer here necessarily, because, you know, that's already led to a lot of issues where people who, or we've seen, for example, attempts to chip away at that in really obtuse ways. For example, the Stop Enabling Sex Trafficking Act, which happened earlier this year, which said that you know, any activity that kind of allows for, or like facilitates sex trafficking, or if that's knowingly happening on a platform, then those platforms are liable for that activity, which caused platforms to shut down a lot of, you know, consensual adult sex work that that was being advertised on their platform. So, for example, like Craigslist shut down its personals ads. Mm. And so, you know, it would lead to a very, very, very different internet, and in fact, make the internet that a lot of people kind of rely on to do for their work kind of not a liable, or not a source that would be viable. But I'm not sure what a different liability framework would look like. But the fact that there is no responsibility now, that they have no liability for what people say, has caused them to look away, and has like really led to an internet that, or at least these internet companies kind of have lived in this framework where they don't have any responsibility. You know, if you go into a restaurant.
Well, let me back up the question a second then. Instead of asking you what the solution is, which I understand is a big lift.
It is.
Who is actually figuring it out? Like, Is Congress up to it? Are any of the regulatory agencies up to it? Is the think tank Beltway in Washington, D.C., putting serious policy proposals on the table, or is all we're getting saber-rattling at Russia?
We're getting saber-rattling at Russia. We don't really have the regulatory scaffolding right now to think about the internet, you know, from kind of a policy solution perspective. I mean, the FCC deals with wires and with the electromagnetic spectrum. The FTC is supposed to deal with, you know, antitrust and consumer protection and things like that. That's the Federal Trade Commission. Congress has eliminated a lot of its technology expertise on staff. And so there's really not the architecture that's needed to really sit down and think, okay, what would a more accountable, healthy internet look like that kind of provide us the information that we needed in order to participate meaningfully in democracy and also preserve free speech. So, like, we're not seeing, or at least I don't see that kind of expertise really cultivated or really existent right now. But I do know that people like Senator Mark Warner, who I've spoken to, you know, are thinking really critically about this. There was a white paper released by his office earlier this year about potential regulatory solutions for this. But yeah, I mean, it's super it's super interesting or even difficult the way, you know, if a restaurant discriminated against people because of their race, that would be a civil rights issue. If an online group on Facebook discriminated against people because of their race, it would not be a civil rights issue, right? And so we don't have the same offline online laws, and that's because of this liability regime.
All right. April Glazer, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
April Glazer is a tech writer for Slate. She is also one half of their tech podcast, If Then.